Hello and welcome, history friends, patrons all, to our special series on my PhD thesis. Last time we introduced you to the Schleswig-Holstein crisis, which as we've established, Palmerston was not a huge fan of. Schleswig-Holstein was a complex struggle between Danish and German nationalist opinion, but as the issue had been resolved via a treaty signed in London in 1852, Britain couldn't help but feel legally responsible for what happened next. What happened next was a decade of dissatisfaction, and Britain remained committed to a more permanent solution. The final conference between the relevant parties failed to find such a solution in 1862, and in the midst of a Polish uprising, it was learned that the King of Denmark intended to change the constitution in March 1863. As Poland was resolved and the Anglo-French relationship deteriorated, Otto von Bismarck found himself in an ideal position to take advantage. As we'll know from Bismarck Rise, it's impossible to get the full measure of this crisis without looking at what Bismarck did in this, his first of three plots to make Prussia great. We're here for Britain, though, and the way the rhetoric of national honour was used during foreign policy crises, but do check out Bismarck Rise if you want more context. Bismarck proved only one problem in the Schleswig-Holstein jigsaw, though. Denmark was another. Statements were made in Parliament which appeared to confirm that if the Schleswig-Holstein question did result in a second Danish-German war, as it had in 1848, Britain would not stand by and let Denmark be crushed. At least, that was one interpretation of the Prime Minister's speech, but Palmerston later maintained that he really meant that all the signees of 1852 would come to Denmark's aid. But the Danes were content to believe what they wanted to believe about British sympathies, and considering the marriage of the Prince of Wales to a Danish princess, surely London would not allow Denmark to be overrun by German nationalists. There were certainly cabinet members unwilling to accept that outcome, but even among Palmerston and Russell, the very fact that they had no immediate answer for Denmark led them to recommend a withdrawal of Danish forces from Holstein in December 1863. By then, a new Danish king had confirmed the constitution, forcing the German Confederation, for the sake of international law, to occupy the duchies in anticipation of a settlement. This settlement, Germans had now become convinced, would involve the Duke of Augustenburg ruling the duchies as a new middle state within the German Confederation, a prospect which appealed to liberally minded German nationalists, but struck Bismarck as the worst possible outcome. Again, Bismarck's hand, throughout the crisis, reaches out to slap us. Through some diplomatic trickery, he persuaded the Danes to continue resistance, leaving Britain utterly without answers. With no one stopping to pause and consider whether we should talk about this conference yet, German troops, now accompanied by Austro-Prussian regiments, marched into Schleswig in early February 1864. With the war now on in historically Danish territory, since Schleswig resides in the Jutland Peninsula, it was easy to portray Denmark as the victim of an overwhelming invasion. But although Palmerston and Russell fulfilled the roles of hawks throughout the crisis, making use of rhetoric in public and anxious messaging behind closed doors, their wings were easily clipped by a cabinet majority and queen in favour of, essentially, Britain washing its hands of the duchies. Eventually, devoid of any possible solutions, and with a conference in London failing for the final time to reach a negotiated settlement, Britain's hands were indeed washed. Unhappy with this hand-washing, at least on the surface, was the opposition. The Conservatives could be expected to lay into the government for their lack of policy in the crisis and for the spectre of British powerlessness as Denmark was beaten down by a more powerful foe. It was an easy picture to paint, but one of the messages which Conservatives were equally determined to press home was the idea that British influence had been lost. This was a key feature of the debates you're about to hear, and it amounted to a belief that in any major developments that occurred, Britain should either have a say in what happened or be entitled to directly play a role. This was not explicitly stated, but it's the impression I have of contemporary expectations of Britain's power and prestige in the mid-Victorian period. We forget that this idea of exceptionalism came from being the premier world power for several decades, and firmly stamping their legend all over Napoleon's face by 1815. But 50 years later, Britain's position was no longer undisputed. Perhaps the Schleswig-Holstein crisis is the first piece of evidence that the golden age of British power was over. Perhaps it was simply a catastrophic failure committed by a government and prime minister out of touch with how the world now worked. It was, of course, possible for both things to be true at the same time, but Palmerston remained utterly defiant. True to his reputation, Palmerston maintained that all was well, and that the Conservatives, or anyone else, could not have done better. Yet the lack of policy alternatives could not shield the government from criticism forever, and matters came to a head on the 4th of July, when Benjamin Disraeli opened the four-night debate with a searing condemnation of everything that happened so far. Let's check in on how all of this went down as I take you to the second part of the fifth chapter of my PhD thesis. Five. 2. Parliamentary rhetoric and the loss of influence. On the 27th of June, Disraeli had announced his intention to table the long-delayed debate on the government's policy, but as Palmerston noted in a letter to the Queen, it would require some dexterity to frame a censure on the government without implying that they ought to have advised Your Majesty to declare war. Here Palmerston discerned the opposition's main difficulty and the ministerial defence, since the remarkably peaceable feeling in the country meant few statesmen were willing to countenance war. To resolve this flaw in their attack, the opposition concentrated on the government's record in the crisis, making particular use of the language of national honour. Foremost in this attack was the charge that the government had made promises to Denmark and threats to the German powers, and that neither had been fulfilled. The Queen was unsympathetic towards such errors. Following a meeting with former Foreign Secretary Clarendon on the 2nd of July, the Queen wrote in her diary of the deplorable tone of bullying, which did us great harm everywhere and lowered the dignity of the country to such an extent. Clarendon informed the Queen that he had prevented a warning being sent to the German powers not to move their fleets to the Baltic, and the Queen was relieved, since the indignant answer from Vienna and Berlin would only have lowered our prestige still more. That British prestige and dignity had been reduced by the government was thus privately accepted by the Queen, but the opposition determined to publicise such criticism and to argue that their policy had also lowered British influence. Members had good reason to be outraged, or simply perplexed, at the steady accumulation of failures by the government. Cabinet divisions, royal opposition, diplomatic isolation, and the practicalities of dealing with such vast German land forces all contributed to Britain's relative powerlessness by late June 1864. The articulation of this shameful spectacle into a suitable motion was a difficult task, and the elasticity of influence as a term arguably reflected its logical weakness. But what was meant by influence? In the narrowest sense, influence was the ability of one state to compel another state to act in its interests, and was affected by a multitude of variables. Understanding the looseness of the term and the ease with which ministers could contest their charge by pointing to the economic, technological, industrial, or financial species of influence, Disraeli's motion focused on just influence. He believed that a country's just influence results from the conviction of foreign powers that our resources are great and that our policy is moderate and steadfast. By threatening the Germans and abandoning the Danes, Disraeli believed it was impossible to deny, under these circumstances, that the just influence of England in the councils of Europe is lowered. What were the consequences of this? Disraeli insisted that they were most serious, because in exact proportion as that influence is lowered, the securities for peace are diminished. In linking lost influence with reduced security, Disraeli sought to lay this down as a great principle which cannot be controverted in the management of our foreign affairs. Disraeli elaborated further that although Britain may have shrunk, with the reserve of magnanimity from the responsibility of commencing war, its statesmen were now sensitively smarting under the impression that her honour is stained by pledges which ought not to have been given and expectations which I maintain ought never to have been held out by wise and competent statesmen. To those that asked what the conservative policy was, Disraeli asserted that "My policy is the honour of England and the peace of Europe, and the noble lord, Palmerston, has betrayed both." Disraeli's motion expressed regret for the failure to defend Danish integrity before reiterating that these failures lowered the just influence of this country in the councils of Europe and thereby diminished the securities for peace. The difficulties presented by influence's broad meaning granted pro-government organs an opportunity to criticise the opposition's narrow definition of the idea. The Times, now more favourable to Palmerston, was particularly critical and believed that "the just influence of a nation is that which it ought to have and which can never be lowered. Actual influence admits of any amount of bathos, but just influence of none." The Times insisted that "it will always be our duty, for example, to have a word for the weak and a word for the strong, and something more than a word on occasions. If we do this and succeed, we shall retain our just influence. If we fail, we may lose it, not lower it." Yet, reflecting on the recent failures, the Times argued that Britain "has also failed in great company. The failure is not hers alone, but that of the neutral powers, who can hardly be said all to have lowered their just influence, supposing the words to have a meaning." The Times thus concluded, "Neither France, nor Russia, nor England has felt her just influence lowered." Disraeli's motion was also hampered by political realities, including disagreement over German and Danish responsibility for the crisis, which contributed to a largely pacific sentiment within Parliament. More importantly, the key question remained unanswered. Did the Conservatives intend to replace the ministry while adhering to the same policy they now condemned? How would that solve the crisis? Since the debates were widely printed and disseminated, critics could argue that in fact, the opposition's stance was purely performative, born of little more than cynical opportunism. Government defenders also reasoned that regardless of which party governed the country, the Austro-Prussian army would still have crossed into Jutland and forced the issue of the duchies. Painful though it was to see a small nation overcome by the powerful, a solution was outside the limits of British capabilities. Indeed, as Sandiford stressed, the mid-Victorian mind was as yet incapable of conceiving of the ultimate triumph of flagrant injustice, after the immoral Bismarck had destroyed both moral right and public law. Before engaging in a more comprehensive analysis of the key debates, it may be useful to survey the more important rhetorical threads. The common opposition claim was that Russell had issued empty threats to the Germans, which were subsequently exposed, causing disgrace and reducing British influence. Ministers retorted that Russell's warnings of grave consequences were a natural reaction to powers that violated treaties and disturbed the peace. They asserted that the Foreign Secretary had acted in concert with Russia and France, using strong language on the expectation that those powers would preserve the 1852 treaty. That the treaty's signees had abandoned it, they declared, was not Britain's fault, and the country could not act alone to maintain a treaty signed by most of Europe. This aspect of the debate occasionally veered into semantics, as members debated what did or did not constitute a menace in the strictest sense of the term. The other key opposition charge was that by their excessive interference in the Schleswig-Holstein question, the government had misled the Danes into expecting British aid, which had created an obligation and made the Danes more stubborn in anticipation of British support. Palmerston's speech of July 1863 was referenced, though its interpretation was contested. Still, it was difficult for the government to deny the cumulative impact of advising the Danes on several occasions, advice which resulted in the revocation of its constitutional reforms, the evacuation of Holstein and its Danevirke defensive line, and strict instructions to give the Germans no pretext for hostilities. when the German powers crossed into Schleswig regardless on the 1st of February, was Britain not now obliged to aid Denmark, as British advice had placed her in a strategically disadvantageous position? By her partisan behaviour and incautious representations, furthermore, critics lamented that Britain had compromised its role as a mediator. Ministers countered by claiming that belligerent public speeches from both parties, general public sympathy, and the editorials of the press had raised Danish expectations and that it was not the fault of the government. Although members now conceded the obsolescence of the 1852 treaty, ministers reflected that Denmark had repeatedly violated it the previous year, beginning with the March Patent and culminating in the November Constitution. Were the Germans not entitled to seek redress from Denmark under these circumstances, notwithstanding the means through which this satisfaction was wrested? Some radical and liberal critics favoured a policy of non-intervention, while Tories insisted that if the government never intended to aid the Danes, it should have remained silent from the beginning. Disraeli based much of his case on the premise that intervention in the Polish uprising had worsened Britain's diplomatic position, and he was joined by others. Ministers upheld that the public would have been appalled if the government had not so much as protested while clear violations of international law had occurred on their doorstep. To have said or done nothing at all during such a crisis would have represented a true humiliation which the British public could never have tolerated. Further, ministers noted that both France and Russia had issued similarly worded dispatches, yet their decision to remain at peace was described as pragmatic rather than dishonourable. Was this not inconsistent? Members also insisted that Russell's repeated failings degraded British influence and had become disgraceful while connecting these ideas to the motion. Ministers responded that to fail in a noble quest was not dishonourable and that Britain had used its best offices to preserve peace, only to be thwarted by German aggression. If it was dishonourable to try, only to fail, then surely George Canning's record, which was held in such esteem, was dishonourable also? One countercharge from ministers was that the opposition had remained silent during the crisis. Surely if the dishonour was so acute, they would have raised their voices sooner. In fact, this was among the weakest government defences, since opposition figures had protested Russell's policy and complained of the lack of materials from the beginning. It was by no means unusual to avoid scrutiny until a crisis was concluded, but the opposition had delayed tabling a full debate on the Schleswig-Holstein policy at the government's request. Moreover, the opposition did not receive the extensive blue books until late June, greatly reducing their capacity for analysis and comment. The main ministerial defence was to assert that the opposition lacked a policy and that they sought only to enter government, inheriting the policy they now attacked. Just as they had at the opening of Parliament, opposition figures insisted it was not their responsibility to develop a policy, particularly since they lacked the materials, and they condemned the government's record on the basis that they would have done better. Yet, because they lacked a true alternative, Conservatives found that even members appalled by the government's record were unwilling to vote against it if the same course would be followed by a new administration. Finally, members attempted to claim that a vote affirming lost influence would represent a disgrace and that it was impossible in this case to separate the reputation of the country from that of the ministry. Conversely, the opposition insisted that affirming the motion was the best way to demonstrate to the world that the country did not support the ministry's dishonourable policy. It is worth noting the use members made of influence, since it was essentially recast as a synonym which encapsulated the government's failure to defend national honour. The following debates assess in more detail the opposition's attempts to weaponise honour for political ends, a traditional tactic of opposition parties which Palmerston had also employed. The evidence suggests the national honour was not a panacea for the opposition. It required a certain set of circumstances to be successfully leveraged against the government, circumstances which were largely absent from the turmoil of the Schleswig-Holstein question. One could thus argue that policy shortcomings, exacerbated by complex circumstances, appreciably reduced the effectiveness of national honour's weaponisation. Also important was the genuine lack of desire of war. 5.3, The Rhetoric of Influence in Parliamentary Debate. The four-night parliamentary debate between the 4th and 8th of July 1864 represented the rhetorical and political culmination of the Schleswig-Holstein crisis in Britain. Sandiford presented a limited assessment of these debates, but kept the rhetoric of national honour mostly in the background, detracting from his analysis somewhat, considering its prevalence. In this section, these tactics and their significance will be assessed, granting an unprecedented opportunity to explicate this rhetoric and assess its pervasive synonym, influence. Thus, in his reply to Disraeli's motion, Gladstone disagreed that the just influence of England is lowered. Addressing the claim that British isolation had alienated traditional allies to the detriment of this influence, he retorted, "That is not the language which is held by allied and friendly governments." Gladstone then accused Disraeli of drawing on nothing but the almost ribald language of a few obscure journals of the continent. If he consulted British newspapers, Gladstone may have been gratified that the press was heavily critical of Disraeli's motion, although regional papers could present a belligerent tone in the name of high principle and national honour. The traveller, writer and Liberal MP Alexander Kinglake contested charges of lost influence by emphasising British military power, insisting that Britain's influence depended on her actual strength and the best way to maintain her influence was to hoard her resources and to avoid so preposterous a war as that into which they would have been plunged had the decision of the government been other than it had been. Although critical of government failures, Kinglake refused to go the length of saying that the mismanagement had been carried so far that the honour of England was affected as alleged. Kinglake discerned that the true object of Disraeli's motion was to show that by addressing encouragement and advice to Denmark and threats to the other powers, England had placed herself in a situation which made it difficult, if not impossible, for her to recede with honour. Regarding the military species of influence, the Exeter Flying Post argued that although the just influence of England is founded upon her actual strength, it charged that to parade that power against other nations without intending to call it into action, to adopt one policy for the weak and another for the strong, is to lower our influence and bring dishonour on the English name. When her bluffs were thus exposed, this aroused sentiments of humiliation, which General Jonathan Peel, younger brother of the late Prime Minister and a former Secretary for War, brought forward. In General Peel's view, Russell had brought the country to the brink of war, and he challenged whether, if we have escaped, if it has not been solely owing to our having thrown our honour overboard. Peel was certain that national honour would not be maintained by interfering with everybody on every occasion, or by making use of overbearing language. "Is it come to this," Peel lamented, "that the words of the Prime Minister of England, uttered in the Parliament of England, are to be regarded as mere idle menaces, to be laughed at and despised by foreign powers?" "Women," Peel declared, "fight with words, monks with curses, men with swords," and although he had not the slightest wish to see this country engaged in a war of the latter description, it was clear that the only way to prevent it with honour was to avoid those two other methods of warfare, in the exercise of which the noble lords, the Prime Minister and Foreign Secretary, have become such adepts, that neither woman nor monk would have the slightest chance with them. And yet, this war of words is neither safe nor honourable. Russell might claim that British prosperity was such that she did not need to fight, yet, Peel challenged, what would be said in private life of a man who refused to defend his honour on the ground that he was too rich to be shot at? Although desirous of preserving both the peace and the honour of the country, Peel proclaimed that the government had imperiled the one and tarnished the other. "I say emphatically that you have tarnished the honour of the country." Absent from Peel's rhetoric was any suggestion of alternative policies. He likely discerned, in common with his colleagues, that the best method for impressing the government's failures upon the public was to use the familiar lexicon and logic of honour. Lord Stanley clarified what the motion meant, labelled as insanity, the prospect of Britain fighting a war for Denmark alone, and challenged the position that the estimation in which England is held just now can be considered as gratifying to English feeling. Stanley could not recall a time when the policy and the position of England have been spoken of all over the continent as they are spoken of now. That was not merely a question of newspapers, as Gladstone had claimed. Instead, that a humiliation had been incurred was a sentiment also felt by Englishmen abroad. Stanley explained these sentiments with reference to obligations incurred to Denmark, because when you take a man's or a nation's affairs out of their own hands, and when you assume the duty of advising, managing, directing, and when that is done by a very strong power to a very feeble one, you must incur a moral responsibility towards those who take your advice. You are giving an implied guarantee that they shall not suffer by taking your advice. Stanley observed that it was possible for a nation to get into such a position that it has before it the alternative of war on the one hand, and on the other, I will not say of dishonour, but discredit. The London Evening Standard continued to carry the banner for the opposition, asserting, "If Whigs be capable of remorse or shame, the colleagues of Lord Russell suffered last night almost as they deserved to suffer. Britain was left without influence abroad or dignity at home, with ruined prestige and damaged self-respect, in a position of deep embarrassment, painful helplessness, and bitter humiliation." But conservative claims that silence was better than any intervention at all also came under attack. In their 5th of July issues, several regional newspapers carried an important speech made by Lord Brougham to the Social Science Association on the 2nd of July, wherein the Liberal peer challenged the opposition claim that it was better to remain entirely aloof rather than intervene and receive snubs for its efforts. "Disinterested silence," Brougham declared, "would have been a true humiliation and would have been anathema to English character." So, it is pretty clear from the above analysis that there was room to criticise Palmerston's policy during the Schleswig-Holstein crisis, and that much of this criticism was delivered through the rhetoric of national honour. Almost every error could be presented in these terms and measured against its impact upon the country's honour and influence. Where the opposition interpreted failure, we could argue that the government's lack of response to the crisis was a symptom of its division. With Palmerston and Russell eager for intervention, at least on a point of principle, but the majority of cabinet and the crown opposed, some amount of paralysis was perhaps inevitable. But, though this inefficiency was noted, what contemporaries were more horrified at was the spectacle of empty threats, which Russell had issued against the Germans and which had arguably characterised the Prime Minister's initial reaction to the crisis. This policy was referred to as blustering, empty menace, or bluff, and it's worth taking some quotes in the footnotes to show you how widespread such criticism was. Disraeli attacked this tactic from the beginning, noting that the government's policy consisted of menaces never accomplished and promises never fulfilled. Although burdened by the difficulties and complications of their newfound isolation, the government did never hesitate in their tone, and seemed at least to rejoice in the phantom of a proud courage. Disraeli added, "We have menaced Austria, and Austria has allowed our menaces to pass her like the idle wind, while Prussia has defied us." Threats against Frankfurt, the capital of the German Confederation, rattled over the head of the German Diet, and the German Diet has treated them with contempt. The more radical MP Richard Cobden agreed, declaring that the great fault of British policy was that we allow ourselves to be betrayed into something like threats without duly measuring the powder we have to carry out our menaces. There is, I say, a policy of menace in this country. Salisbury insisted that if we did not mean to fight, we ought not to interfere, and that if we did not intend to carry out by arms our threats and measures, we must abstain from the luxury of indulging in them. Tory MP Henry Butler Johnston claimed that Russell had threatened so often that these impotent menaces which it was never intended to carry out, have left their sting with those who have dared to use them. Edward Horseman believed that British councils have been slighted, her warnings disregarded, her menaces derided, while Prussia, flushed with impunity, had mocked, bearded, and almost threatened us with an insolence which has left us almost cowering from the shame of misleading and abandoning a small and kindred state, which Britain was, bound by the most solemn obligations to protect. On the 7th of July, Sir Francis Goldsmith complained that, without having assured themselves of the aid either of France or Russia, the government had held out to Germany distinct threats, which, unless with the help of one of those empires, they were not prepared to carry into effect. On the final day of the debate, James Whiteside asserted that the government, instead of pursuing a policy of wisdom and moderation, had recourse to menaces and threats unaccompanied by corresponding action, and from this inconsistent, capricious, and therefore mischievous policy has sprung the present condition of affairs. But defenders of the government disputed these interpretations, basically seeing in these menaces something other than menaces. On the 7th of July, the Undersecretary for Foreign Affairs, Austin Laird, stated that Earl Russell cannot be accused of using threats, and the language he has employed has invariably been approved and even adopted by France, that he has not been unnecessarily meddling, and that Russell had supported the honour of his country, and that throughout these most difficult and delicate negotiations he has shown an ardent desire to maintain peace. That same day, the Attorney General, Randall Palmer, asserted that when the British government say that we cannot look with indifference upon the invasion of Schleswig, honourable gentlemen opposite regard it as a menace and a threat of going to war, yet when France says so, the declaration is regarded in a very different manner. Such language meant that she is perfectly peaceable and by no means disposed to go to war, and Palmer suggested that if you try by that test all the language in these documents which is called the language of menace, then members would soon find that every single expression was echoed, assented to, and repeated both by France and Russia. In the House of Lords on the 8th of July, the Duke of Argyll insisted, it was our bounden duty to warn the German powers of the danger they were incurring, and Argyll believed that we should have forfeited our duty as ministers of the English crown if we had not held out such intimations to the German powers. So the government hadn't threatened. It had merely expressed its disfavour for aggression, and warned, as did other powers, of the consequences which might follow. We know that Palmerston and Russell were in fact more gung-ho when it came to intervention, particularly when rumours of an Austrian navy sailing towards the Baltic and past the Channel were discussed. Palmerston's reaction was so fierce that the Austrian ambassador sank into a kind of depression, which Disraeli also noticed. We could see the Schleswig-Holstein crisis as a collision between the old methods of statesmen, who were accustomed to Britain getting its way by leveraging its naval power and coercing its rivals, particularly when the national honour was at stake, and the new reality of the 1860s, which stated that Britain was not in fact as powerful as supposed, and that her diplomacy could easily be repelled by a party that possessed the military advantage, particularly on land. It was one thing to threaten weaker minor powers, but when dealing with someone like Bismarck, who was himself very well versed in the use of threats, we might say that Palmerston and Russell attempted to BS a BSer. This was bound to fail, and this may have been the defining failure of British policy. Looking even to the Trent affair 3 years before, we note that when Britain threatened, the required naval forces needed to back up that threat against the Union was provided. But what had Britain done to communicate its seriousness to the German powers? Aside from recalling the navy and making concerned noises, the desire to intervene, which Palmerston and Russell may have sincerely possessed, was never realised in practical terms. This brings us back to cabinet divisions, which had the effect of neutering policies which went too far for the Pacific majority. If you can track down Keith Sandiford's book on the crisis, you'll see for yourself how many times the cabinet met only to do nothing and craft a policy of wait and see instead. When peace between the parties was out of the question, we imagine a new strategy would have been devised, but the government seemed content to stand back and watch what happened next, even as Holstein, Schleswig, and eventual actual Danish land was invaded. As ministers fairly pointed out, Denmark was partially to blame for this. Its own behaviour in provoking the Germans with a new constitution, stubbornly refusing to compromise, granted the Germans the excuse to intervene in the name of legal propriety. Denmark put itself legally in the wrong, even if the Germans, by their invasion, were legally compromised. That said, just because the government's representations had been ignored, this didn't mean Britain was humiliated. As Lord Brougham declared during a speech widely referenced in several newspapers, there was a too prevailing feeling that this country has been humbled, if not disgraced, by its refusal to act. Brougham argued that we should have been humbled and disgraced if we had not expressed what all of us felt and had a right to feel about the Danish struggle, and Brougham believed that it was rather a step in social progress that instead of having recourse to the sword on all occasions, the government tried the effect of that moral influence upon them and the public at large. It was honesty to protest, Brougham concluded, because the government would have been disgraced and dishonoured, and the country also, if they had not made such protestation and if they had not given their advice, even though they expected it would be rejected. If not obliged to aid its Danish friend through military means, Britain was at least obliged to do something, and while its protest may have been viewed as weak, Britons were coming to terms with the fact that in some situations, notwithstanding her rank and power, Britain could not alter the pace of events. This brought forward claims of lost influence, which were closely connected to the idea of dishonour. But Disraeli's attempt to use lowered influence as a catch-all term for government failure arguably backfired, since influence, like national honour, could be interpreted in a wide variety of places. There was influence of a military, cultural, social, moral, industrial, economic, and diplomatic kind, and it was thus hysterical to suggest that all of these attributes had been lowered at the same time. The debate on influence was destined to continue, and in the next episode we'll resume our coverage, so I hope you'll join me for that. Until then, my dear history friend and patron, thank you so much for supporting and listening to this show. I have been Dr. Zach. This has been the second part of the fifth chapter of my thesis. Thanks so much, and I'll be seeing you all soon.